we said that a person who does not consider what he's doing, both before and afterwards, is inevitably going to end up doing things that are wrong, and even the things that he does right are going to be mixed with negative things. And then he's explaining the Maimer Chazal Bo Cheshbon, that the people who are Moshlim B'Yitzram, people who already conquered their Yetzer Hara, tell the people who haven't yet learned how to conquer it, Bo Cheshbon, to make the accounting of the world, to consider everything you do, the upside, the downside, and so on. And he says, Lamaisa, going through this world, a person is like going through the night. And a person who hasn't yet mastered his Yetzer Hara always runs the risk of the two dangers that happen at night. One is that you can't see where you're going. So you totally miss different dangerous things that may be in the way. And we spoke about that last week, that the Yetzer Hara makes you want to think that there are no problems, that there is no Yetzer Hara, and everything is fine, everything you can do. And in the first little thing comes and you trip up. And then the second thing is, which is even worse, not just that you don't see the dangers, but you distort them. And you see what's good is bad, and you see what's bad is good. That in the dark, sometimes a person looks like a pole, and a pole looks like a person, and you totally distort what lies ahead of you. That's what he's going to be speaking about now. So we're up to... there is it. Vatos Hasheni. Who? The Koshim in Harishon. The first mistake that people make who are walking in the dark, meaning who have not yet learned to control the Yetzer Hara, which is all of us, is that you don't see the dangers. The second mistake in the dark is the Hu Koshim in Harishon, and that's much more difficult, much more dangerous than the first mistake, shemate riyosam, that you distort what you see. Ad sheroim hara ki iluhu mamish tov, v'hatov ki iluhu ra. You see the good as if it's bad, and you see the bad as if it's good. U'mitoch kach mischazkim u'machzikim aseim aroim. And in that way, a person doesn't only ignore the bad, but he strengthens the bad because he thinks it's good. So he thinks he's doing mitzvahs when he's really doing averas. And he thinks he's staying away from averas when he's staying away from mitzvahs. Ki ein dai shechos mehem riyas ha'emes, liros ha'roh asher neged p'neihem. It's not only that people who can't control the Yetzer Hara are missing the ability to see the truth, and they don't see it at all. Ela shenir lohem limso rayos gedolos v'nisyonos mochichim l'svaroseim ha'roz u'ledeoseim ha'kozlos. They bring proof and justify all of the negative things that are bad, and they justify and think that they're good, and bring proofs to them and strengthen them or whatever. The Zoshi Haro HaGedola, and this is the worst kind of evil, HaMelafefesan U'mevim HaBershachas, and this surrounds them and brings them and makes them fall into Gehenna. The heart of these people is fat. It's covered with fat. Because they're walking in the darkness means that they're still under the rule of the Yetzer Hara. So let's speak about this. We spoke last week about how the Yetzer Hara can make you not realize that there are pitfalls, and if you don't anticipate problems, then you're not able to deal with them. You're not able to overcome them. And the smallest little problem comes and pushes you out of the way, and that's how the Yetzer Hara gets you. That's how he traps you, by making you unaware of the fact that there are yetzirahs, that there are pitfalls and things that present problems. Another example of that, how a person can totally ignore things that a normal person would see, and a person is able to ignore them, and also it borders already on distorting it. There's a Rashi, very difficult Rashi in Lech Lecha. Rashi says that Melech Sodom and Melech Amora, who were part of the five kings that were vanquished by the four kings. That's when Melech Sodom was chased out of Sodom, and the four kings captured all the people there, including Lot, and took them captive and all of their property. And that's when Avraham Avinu went and fought against the four kings and vanquished them and saved Lot. So it says that Melech Sodom and Melech Amora ran away from the battle because they were losing. And they ran through what was in that time like a minefield. And there was a Be'eros Chemar. There were pits of lime. And Melech Sodom fell in one of those pits. Now, lime usually burns you up. Right? It's a very strong base. So it's like, what's it called? What's that very strong base that they use for kashering things? What's it called? A caustic soda. Caustic soda, mamash, burns like acid, except it's the opposite of an acid. It's a base. So the lime has the same power. So Melech Sodom should have been dissolved in this lime pit. And miraculously, he was saved. He was saved miraculously. So Rashi says, why did the Rabban Shalom do a miracle for the king of Sodom, who was a Russian? Why did he save his life? So Rashi says, because there were people who didn't believe that Avraham Avinu was saved from the fiery furnace of Nimrod. And when they saw that Melech Sodom was saved, they believed in Avraham retroactively. Haminu b'Avraham l'mafreya. Because if Melech Sodom could be saved, then Avraham Avinu also could have been saved. So retroactively, they believed in Avraham. The Ramban asks on this Rashi, he doesn't understand what's going on. So first of all, what in the world does Melech Sodom being saved have to do with Avraham? Maybe they believed that Melech Sodom was saved. They still didn't believe in him. They didn't believe in Avraham yesterday. Why now they believe in him today? And he says, and if Rashi means to say that Melech Sodom was saved when Avraham Avinu came near the pit and looked in, and in the schus of Avraham, then Melech Sodom was elevated from the pit. Iker Chosim and HaSefer. None of that is written in the Rashi or in the Medrash. So if that's the main thing, that Melech Sodom was saved in the schus of Avraham, how do you know? Because Avraham came by the pit. Doesn't mention anything about that. So the Ramban ends with a question on Rashi. Doesn't understand Rashi. I want to explain Rashi in the following way. And that's the following. First of all, how is it possible that people didn't believe that Avraham Avinu was saved from the Kivshan Ha'esh? It wasn't something that happened privately. It was a public show that Nimrod made in order to prove that Avraham Avinu was not right when he was saying there was another God besides Nimrod. What happened was that Avraham Avinu was going around telling people that there was a God and Nimrod wasn't God. And Nimrod didn't take too kindly to that. And Avraham Avinu's own father, Terach, out of fear, handed him over to Nimrod. And Nimrod decided he's going to make a spectacle of Avraham Avinu and once and for all show that his idea that there's one God is false. Because he's going to burn him to ashes and the God's not going to help him. So he called together everybody to witness Avraham Avinu being reduced to ashes. It was a public execution. And he threw Avraham into the oven, never expecting him to survive, and Avraham Avinu came out unscathed. So that means everybody witnessed it. It was a historical occurrence. How could it be that people didn't believe? Millions of people, thousands of people, hundreds of thousands, whatever, saw it. It wasn't a secret, it wasn't a hidden private thing. How is it possible that people didn't believe? The answer is that people didn't want to believe that Avraham Avinu was saved. Because if they believed Avraham Avinu was saved, that means that there's a God. And if there's a God, then I am responsible to him. And he created me. And I'm not interested in being responsible. So people have the ability to blind their eyes from seeing the truth. Rambam says that a chote, a person who is in the hands of his Yetzer Hara, is called an iver. Lifnei iver lo sitei miksho. Shetaivos libo ma'avrin es eino miliros emes. They blind the taivas, blind your eyes from seeing the truth. There are Holocaust deniers. How in the world could anyone deny the Holocaust? It was a historical fact. Now, how could there be Holocaust deniers? And we're not talking only about Meshugoyim like Ahmadinejad. We're talking about college professors who are also tipshit, right? But they don't believe in the Holocaust. What happened to 6 million Jews are hiding under the bed somewhere, or whatever. I don't know what they think. The ovens in Auschwitz were bakeries, or whatever. It's unbelievable. What kind of ability to blind your eyes from seeing the truth? Why? Because they are anti-Semites. They hate Jews, and this brings mercy to Jews, and they don't want to have mercy to Jews. So therefore, they don't believe in the Holocaust. Finished. Doesn't happen. Never. Doesn't exist. A person has the ability to blind his eyes in more simple things. People who smoke. Take a cigarette carton, pack, says on it, the Surgeon General has determined that cigarette smoking is harmful to your health. Whatever it says there, it says worse than that. And they smoke. How can you smoke, right, and ignore that? The answer is you're blinded. You don't consider it. You like smoking. It's enjoyable. And the taiva blinds your eyes from seeing the truth. Or you can distort things. Somebody, an intelligent person, once told me that he smokes because all the research they did on cigarette smoking, determining how dangerous it is, was only on Goyim who smoke 7 days a week. But he only smokes 6 days a week. So Mela, all the research is batel mevutel. It means nothing. Now, to him, that made a lot of sense. He really meant it. Right? To me, that's the most idiotic thing I've ever heard in my life. But that's the Yetzer Hara. Right? It enables you to totally blind your eyes from seeing the truth, from just ignoring. Right? So, let me give you an example first, then we'll go back to Avraham Avinu and Melech Sodom. Prior to around 1950, 1960, it was unscientific to believe in a soul. People were chemicals, 98 cents worth of chemicals. Today with inflation, it's probably a lot more. But then it was 98 cents of chemicals, and that's all. It was a bunch of physical, material things with electronic impulses that go from the nerves to the muscles or whatever, and the brain. And a person was a machine, basically, like everything else. And there was no such thing as any spiritual side to man. Anybody who believed in that was some kind of religious fanatic and a dreamer. That was the scientific view of the world. And if you didn't believe like that, you were unscientific and you were basically excommunicated from the scientific community. Then came on the scene a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She was a social worker who worked with terminally ill people. And she noticed that a lot of these people, she wrote a book on death and dying, how to deal with terminally ill people, but she also wrote another book, and together with a Protestant minister. She noticed that a lot of these people who were terminally ill at times died clinically. In other words, basically they had all the signs of death, and then they came back. And most of them recorded very similar things of what happened to them when they were clinically dead. We once went through this years and years ago when we spoke about Misa. They said that what they reported is very similar to what the Zohar says happens to a person as their neshama leaves the body. You see a big light and whatever, and you see your whole life go before you, whatever. Mamish, what's it called? And they all basically said the same things. Okay, now, it's true that the Christians said they saw Yashka or Mary or whatever, and the Muslims saw Mohammed or whatever, but that's no kasha. Why that's the case. We're not going into now why, but in any case, it's But this is the, otherwise it was very similar stages of what happens in the neshama after a person dies. Somebody, without mentioning any names or anything, after they heard that shiur, then told me that they had a similar experience. They never told anybody about it because they were afraid they would think they were crazy. But when they were younger, they had almost drowned, and at that point, when they almost drowned, they felt their neshama leaving their body and watching the people trying to save this person on the beach. And they remember thinking to themselves at the time, don't save me. I feel great, right? Floating here, this is a very, very euphoric feeling, and I don't want to go back. And Lamaisa, though, they worked on the person, and they brought them back, and they felt themselves going back into their body. So I heard from somebody firsthand who had that experience. So she wrote this book. The book, I forgot, what was it called? I don't remember what the name of the book was. It's a famous book. And but she didn't say that it was a soul. Basically, what they said was, okay, there is a certain part of the human body that's not, had nothing to do with spiritual religion. It's called an astral projection, which you can project outside your being, and you could really be in two places at the same time. A person could have a dream and see what's going on the other end of the world, but it's not nothing to do with religion, nothing to do with souls. It's just another part. It has to do with extrasensory perception, ESP. And all of a sudden, it became scientific to believe in this. Now, why? Till now, it wasn't scientific because nobody saw a soul, nobody put it in a test tube, nobody weighed it, and now they did? No. So why all of a sudden was it okay to believe in this astral projection, which was no different than the old soul? The answer is very simple. Until now, they had no other explanation than the fact that it has something to do with God and religion. And their Yetzer Hara would not let them accept it. So they blinded their eyes from any semblance of such a thing. But once they had another way of explaining it, and it has nothing to do with God, nothing to do with religion, it's an astral projection, right? And it's within the realm of science, even though it's no more provable than it was before, now we can believe in it. Because the implications don't exist anymore. I don't believe in what I don't want to believe. And what bothers me, I blind my eyes to. It doesn't bother me, I can open my eyes to it. So yesterday I couldn't believe in it, today I can. That's exactly what Rashi's saying here. People did not believe that Avram was safe in the Kibshon or Eish. How could it be? It was a historical occurrence. It was a public occurrence. They blinded their eyes. They closed their eyes. I'm not interested in believing it. I don't want to believe in smoking is dangerous. I don't want to believe in the Holocaust. I don't want to believe that Avram was safe in the Kibshon or Eish because the implications are there's a God, and I'm not interested. So I don't believe it. How could it be? Finished. I don't believe it. The people don't believe they landed on the moon either. They think it was staged somewhere in Nevada. Okay, fine. Believe anything. People still believe the world is flat. Whatever you want, if that's what you want, harotza litos ita. You want to make a mistake, you'll make a mistake. You believe what you want to believe. Right? That's a famous medrash. The medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to write the pasuk, Nasa adam mitzalneinu, let us make man, so he said, I can't write this. You're giving a mokum laminim litos. The early Christians, the people believed in more than one God, a trinity, whatever, are going to bring a proof in this pasuk that there's more than one God. Because it says, let us make man. So the Rabban Shem told him, so, if you write what I told you, anybody wants to make a mistake, let them make a mistake. Not my interest, not my business, not my problem. They want to make a mistake, it's okay. Now the Rabban Shem told us, not allowed to put a stumbling block in front of people. So why wouldn't God be concerned that he's causing people to make a mistake and to believe in two gods? The answer is, the tells the Rosh Hashiva, that's where I heard it, Harotza litos yita. A person who wants to make a mistake is going to make a mistake no matter what. Nobody ever became an apikoros because it says nasa of it. No one. No one believed in one God and came to this pasuk in the Chumash in first grade, raised his hand and said, I got to go to the convent down the block because it says nasa of it. Nobody in seventh grade, nobody when they learned it and as an adult, no one ever became an apikoros. Why? Look at Rashi. Rashi says, what's Nasa of them? God said to the angels, let us together make man. He taught us a lesson. We should ask advice from even someone lower than us. So to teach us that lesson, they should ask advice. If God could ask advice from the angels, then there's nobody who can't ask advice from anybody. Or, the Ramban says, Nasa Adam, God said, together with the earth, let us make man. The earth will provide its part, and the Rabban will provide his part, the Neshama, and that's how man was made. And it's clear, it doesn't mean there's two gods, because the end of the Pasuk says, Vayas Elokim es Adam, in the singular, God made. So, what's it called? It's clear from the Pasuk that it doesn't mean there's two gods. But somebody who wants to believe in two gods will bring a proof from here. So, it doesn't make a difference what it says. Somebody who wants to make a mistake will find anywhere he can to make a mistake. And I always like to say the Maisa over of the Goy who thought he was Mashiach years and years ago. At that point, only Goyim thought they were Mashiach. He, what's it called, wanted to prove to the world he was Mashiach, but the internet didn't exist then. So how did he get to the world to convince him he's Mashiach? So he devised the following plan. He will write to all the clergymen in New York, priests, ministers, rabbis, convince them he's Mashiach, and they have congregations. So if he convinces one of these priests, rabbis, or whatever, they can convince their whole congregation. So one letter will get him hundreds of followers through the rabbi, the priest, or the minister. So the Rav that I was staying at for Ben Azmanim, wasn't married yet, got one of these letters. He showed it to me. The guy wanted to convince him he's Mashiach, so he sent him 10 proofs that he was Mashiach. And he said, now that you're convinced that I'm Mashiach, could you please announce to your congregation that I'm Mashiach and wait for further instructions? What was the proofs? Right? It should have been ironclad proofs that this guy was Mashiach. They all went the same way as this one. I don't remember them, but I remember the first one. The first one was the following. It says in Yeshayahu, concerning Mashiach, that Mashiach will be lamala mimalachim. He will be, in English, above kings. Okay? He'll be above kings. So he said, it obviously is referring to me. Because in the apartment underneath me, there are two dogs named King. That puts me above kings. So obviously, Yeshayahu was referring to me. Couldn't be clearer. And all the other proofs were pretty much the same. So, that's it. The person thought for sure that he was Mashiach, and he brought his proof. You want to make a mistake, you bring your proof from anything. You can distort anything, you can deny anything, you can blind your eyes to anything. That's the way it is. So people refused to believe that they, what's it called? So that's what the Rebbe told Moshe Rabbeinu. You write what it says, teach people the lesson, and anybody who wants to make a mistake is not going to help to change it. They'll find some other way of making a mistake. Anybody who wants to believe, whatever it may be. I had another guy once called me on a Friday. Most of these things usually happen on Fridays. The guy calls me on Friday. He tells me, I have good news. I'm Mashiach, and God told me to call you first. So my ego didn't let me say that it's not Shaykh. I mean, anything's possible. So I said, okay. Who are you? Are you Jewish? Yeah, I'm Jewish. Are you religious? What do you mean by that? I said, well, let's start with something obvious. Are you a Sabbath observer? He said, well, not exactly. I said, okay, you're Mashiach and you're not Shomer Shabbos. That presents a problem. I said, but let's go on to the next stage. Okay, so you're Mashiach and God told you to call me. Okay, what does he want you to tell me? He said, he wants me to tell you that we are supposed to go to Israel and build the Beis HaMikdash together. They're very nice. I said, from what I understand, I've never been there, but I understand that there's a mosque on the place where the Beis HaMikdash is supposed to be built. What exactly are we going to do with that mosque? He said, no, we're not building the Beis HaMikdash in Jerusalem. We're building it in Beersheba temporarily, where I have a plot of land. And we're putting up a tent as a temporary Beis HaMikdash until we can, work it out with the Arabs to build it on Har HaBayis. I said, okay, so God wants us to go to Beersheba, put up this tent. Very nice. How are we going to get there? He said, that's why God wanted me to call you. He said, you have to buy the tickets. I said, you know what? If you're still Mashiach on Sunday, call me back. It's Friday. I'm very, very busy. In any case, so people can believe anything they want and distort anything they want, if that's what they want. Mela, when Avraham Avinu was saved from the Kibshon HaEish, nobody believed it because they didn't want to believe it. On the other hand, because it meant that there's a God who saved Avraham, and that has implications that I'm not interested in admitting to. But then Melech Sodom was saved in a similar way. So now the people said, you know, Melech Sodom is a Russia. This does not imply that there's a God who saved him. Why in the world would God want to save Melech Sodom? So it must be that there are miracles that happen that have nothing to do with God, that are extrasensory perception, that are astral projections, right? It's possible for people to be saved from a fiery furnace or from a lime pit, which is similar, and nothing to do with God. Because why in the world would God want to save Melech Sodom? Now I have another way of explaining what happened to Avraham Avinu. It has nothing to do with God. Now, believe in it, Lamafreya. That's why it says they believed in it retroactively. They didn't believe in it from then on. Now they opened their eyes and they said, now I can believe. Yesterday I couldn't believe it because of the implications. It's all subconscious. Today I can believe it because today I have another explanation. Today it has nothing to do with God. So just like Melech Sodom was saved in a miraculous way and miracles can happen without any God, so too, what happened yesterday happened without any God, and it's no implication about Avraham Avinu. That's what Rashi means.
What would be the significance of...
Why did the Rabban Shem do that? To show these people how fickle they were. To show that yesterday you didn't believe this. Today you do. What changed? Only that you can explain it differently. Maybe that would give them the incentive to do true. Maybe they realize how fickle they were. That's why the Rabban Shem did it. Right? To show them why today yes and yesterday not. What changed? Elamai, you have a different explanation. So maybe you'll understand that. Maybe some people would do true because of that. That's why. So in any case, so that's how a person can blind his eyes from seeing the truth. The opposite is also true. Not only can you blind your eyes from seeing the truth and deny something, but you can make it what's it called the opposite. The Rebbe Chanan in Kovitz Maamorim, famous first Maamor in Kovitz Maamorim, speaks about evolution. Right? And basically, he speaks about a Chovas HaLevavos, which I'm just going to update a little bit, and then I'll tell you another story. The Rebbe Chanan asked the following question. It says, Lo sasuru achri levavchem v'achare ineichem. It shouldn't go after your eyes and your heart. So your eyes is nus. I understand that. What you see, and that leads you to immorality. But after your heart is apikursis, is minus. L'chora, apikursis is not in your heart. It's in your mind. It should have said, Lo sasuru achrei datchem, roshchem. Not after your heart. Heart is emotion. That's one question. Second question he asks is, Aristotle did not believe in God. And he was the smartest man, the Rambam says, one step under prophecy. The next step up was prophecy. And Aristotle didn't believe in God. And every 12-year-old girl and 13-year-old boy has to believe in God. How could that be? How could you expect from a 12-year-old and 13-year-old what Aristotle couldn't come to? And he has some other questions there, but those are the two major ones. So the answer he gives is the following. I'm just going to update a little bit. He says, if you would ask somebody, how did this watch get here? Okay? There's a lot of parts that have to work together or synchronized or whatever to make a watch. One way is that a watchmaker made it. I never saw the watchmaker. I don't know who he is. But I assume that somebody knows how to make watches made it. Or another possibility. And it's, both are possible. Shaila's, which is more probable? There were a lot of watch parts on the table. And over hundreds of thousands of years, right, the wind came and blew these parts off the table constantly, off, on, off, on, until one day they just fell together and made the watch. Which one's more probable? They're both possible. Which one's more probable? No sane person would say it's more probable that the watch just fell together. There probably was an intelligent watchmaker who made it. Secondly, the human eye. What's it called? The dictionary. How did the dictionary get here? Either there were infinite amount of monkeys typing on an infinite amount of computers, and just by accident, they type the dictionary. Just happened to work out like that. Or a person wrote and published a dictionary who understood how to write dictionaries. Which way is more probable? Both are possible. But the more probable way, everybody would assume, is that somebody intelligent wrote their dictionary. Okay, now, third. So far, everybody's in agreement. Nobody would choose that it's more probable the monkeys or the wind pushing the watch off the table. Human eye. How did the human eye get here? One possibility, there's an intelligent creator that created all of creation and fashioned the human eye, which is more complicated than any video camera. Right? This is more live than that's live. Okay? So, and it doesn't need to have batteries changed or constantly, what's it called, charged or, and it really great. Okay? Normally lasts for 90, 100 years, 120 years, whatever, works great. Okay. That's one possibility. An intelligent creator fashioned the human eye, or is another possibility. There were hydrogen atoms floating in space. Where the space came from and where the hydrogen atoms come from, that's the free space on the bingo card, right? That nobody can answer, right? Just, it was always there. There was always space and there was always hydrogen atoms, and they were very happy being hydrogen atoms because they didn't know to be anything else. And you can't ask the same question if you start with God, because God's out of the system. God, by definition, is eternal. But if you don't accept anything out of the system, then things are not eternal. Either they were made by something, or they can't make themselves. So where do they come from? If you don't accept anything out of the system of nature, then you have a problem how did things get started. If you accept the fact that this is God who's out of the system, then he's out of the system. He's eternal. So in any case, so where do the hydrogen atoms come from? Where did the space come from? No one knows. That's a given. Okay? So the hydrogen atoms were floating in space, and one day for reasons unknown, they imploded, exploded, whatever. There was this big bang, and now the, what's it called? There was fusion. So the hydrogen atoms became more complex atoms, which is not what happens today. What happens today is that there's fission, not fusion. Things don't by nature combine, but they disintegrate. But we have to believe that way back then, things happened unscientifically, not the way we know them. Okay, so now all these atoms, what's it called, were mechuber together, and now we have the whole periodic table of elements. And these elements were now floating around in space also, and they formed what's it called, stars. And one day, two stars were skipping millions and millions of years. Two stars got close to each other, and one pulled some material off of the other one and set it revolving around it, and that was our solar system, which is a problem because in recent years, they found that there are parts of the solar system that go retrograde, that go the opposite way. If they've been pulled off and sent going to go, they should all be going the same way. So somebody must have stopped them, pushed them the other way, or whatever, at some point. But there are certain moons of certain planets that go the opposite way of everything else. And that's impossible to explain according to this theory. Okay, but whatever. Takasha. Tzorichi. I take whatever. So you don't have to answer every kasha. That's okay. Okay, we'll skip a few more millions of years. And those pieces of matter cooled down. Some of them were very close to this star called the sun, and they were too hot to have life. Some were too far away, and they were too cold to have life. And there was one, like Goldilocks' porridge, that was just right in the middle, and just by chance was just not too hot and not too cold, and could have water vapor condense, and that was ripe for life. What is life? Well, there were all these, what's it called, chemicals, right, proteins and amino acids or whatever that are the building blocks of life, and they were floating around the sea like this big soup, and one day the lightning hit the sea and it created from all these unliving things the first amoeba, the first one-celled life. Now scientists have been trying to do that on purpose for years, and they can't. They can't take all the amino acids, all the anything, put it into a test tube, put as much electricity through it as you want, hit it by lightning, stamp on it, yell at it, do whatever you want, it never becomes life. But it happened by accident. Just one day, just by accident, there's the amoeba. Okay, the amoeba carries on all the the, what's it called, the functions of life, and it's very happy being an amoeba. Right? It doesn't miss anything, and it's just being an amoeba for who knows how long. One day, the amoeba, instead of, what's it called, dividing and having another amoeba, the amoeba has a paramecium instead of an amoeba, right, which are many cells. Now, that would be comparable to the following. Woman goes to the hospital to have a baby. And doctor comes and he says, Mazel tov, it's a giraffe. Giraffe? I wasn't expecting a giraffe. He said, well, you know, these things happen every once in a while. That's why people have giraffes instead of children. It's more possible for a woman to have a giraffe than for an amoeba to have a paramecium. But the mice, that's what happened. And after millions and millions and millions of years, the paramecium had other things until there was fish. Now, these fish just happened by accident. But they were prophetic, very smart fish. Because they knew that a million years in the future, the lakes and rivers were drying up. How they knew that, I don't know. Maybe they were near the bottom and the plug, somebody pulled the plug and they felt the water going out. And they knew that if they didn't develop lungs somehow, that they're going to drown in the air when the rivers dry up. Now, they couldn't develop the lungs right away because then they would drown in the water. So they had to do this slowly, and it coincided with when the rivers dried up. Right, and not only that, so these fish were really, they came by accident, but they were really prophetic, intelligent fish that knew what was going to happen a million years in the future and developed this slowly over the next million years. And then, punk, when the amphibians got out of the water because the rivers were drying up, they found that the plants were also very smart and were evolving at the same time that they were, so they'd have something to eat when they got on the dry land. Because if they didn't, they would die out within days of starvation. So somehow the evolution of the plants coincided accidentally, completely accidentally, with the evolution of the amphibians. And okay, now there's amphibians, and they're walking lizards, whatever. Some of them get tired walking, they develop wings, they become birds. Some of them didn't get tired, they become mammals. One day, a mammal becomes an ape, and one day the ape opens the New York Times and becomes a human being, and that's where the human eye comes from. Take your choice. There's an intelligent creator or this. Why, when it comes to this, are there a lot of people who say that is scientific, that makes sense, and people who believe in an intelligent creator are fairy tale, are dreamers, are religious fanatics? Same exact thing. The answer is simple, says Rabbi Chanan. Because lo sosuru achri levavchem, a person was made yosher. And if he's unbiased, he would see that Taka, there's no difference between the dictionary, the watch, and the world. But a person doesn't want to believe in God. I can believe in a watchmaker. It doesn't bother me at all. Chagi doesn't bother me at all. Right? Watchmakers don't bother me. Neither do dictionary writers. But gods bother me because they limit and cramp my style. So I would like to believe that everything came to Hefker, and I'm just like an animal. I can do whatever I want, rather than believe there's a God who created me and that I'm responsible to. And therefore, my taivas block my eyes from seeing the truth and distort it completely. And I see that as being the truth and this being a fairy tale. When if I'd be objective, I would see just the opposite. I may not be clear, but it's more probable this way than that way. So that's the power that a person has. So I'm going to end with one more story and then I get to this chasana, but this story has to do with a chasana. I must have told it over here a few times, but there are new guys in the yeshiva, so it's good to hear. Because you guys are going to be going out soon, so it's good to hear. I had a girl in my community in Miami. Her father was, to say the least, very eccentric. And he was a big kanoi. He was an eccentric guy. Very nice guy, very emissa guy, but he was very eccentric. One day he burst into my office, mamish. It's a good thing he left the door, right? He opened the door first instead of just coming right through it. And he screams to me, Rabbi, save my daughter's life. So I told him, I think you're confusing me with Hatzalah, right? If your daughter's life is in danger, I'm not the address. He said, no, you're the address. He said, my daughter has been going out on Shiduchim. She met this guy, and she's convinced that this is the guy she's supposed to marry. She wants to marry him. And the guy he went to describe is a combination of Hitler, Mussolini, and Genghis Khan. That's how he described this guy. He was like the worst human being that ever lived in this world. And if my daughter marries this guy, it's the end of her life, and it's destroyed me. You must convince her not to marry this guy. I said, I find it hard to believe that this yeshiva guy is as bad as you say he is. Right? So I'll make you a deal. Let me meet this guy, not knowing that I'm meeting him, what's it called, you know, with any intention. So I'll bump into him and speak to him. If he's as bad as you say, I'll be lucky to get out of there with my life. Right? And I promise you that if I see that you're right, I will convince your daughter to break off the shidduch. But you have to promise me that if I meet him and I see that you're wrong, that you will not stand in your daughter's way of getting married to this guy if that's what she wants. Gave me his word, and I bumped into this guy, supposedly, you know, just by chance. I spent an hour eating lunch with him in a pizza shop in Miami. And after the hour, he wasn't as bad as this guy said, but he was not normal. You know, it was clear. There was something seriously wrong with this guy. Seriously. And it was obvious to me that this guy was not for this girl. So I called the girl in, and I figured that this is going to be easy because she didn't trust her father, and just the opposite. Whatever her father said, she did the opposite. So, because her father was against it, that's why she wanted to marry this guy. But I figured, look, she knows that, you know, at least I'm somewhat, you know, normal, and if I think this guy is really off the wall, then she'll accept that. So I don't remember what there was some serious things that I saw. But let's, for argument's sake, say I discovered that the guy had murdered 7 wives before. Okay? So I told the girl, I said, look, you know, I looked into this guy, I met him, and, you know, he tried to murder me twice during the conversation, and I heard that he murdered 7 wives before this. And she would look at me and say, yeah, but he did it with such sensitivity. So what are you talking about? The guy's a murderer. He murdered them with sensitivity. He's a very sensitive guy. This is the kind of conversation we went back and forth. I was telling her things that in my mind were so obvious that these were negative, and she turned it around to be positive. Why? She liked this guy, and al kol pshayim techasa ava, and her emotions wouldn't let her see anything negative. She totally distorted. I learned a big lesson from that because it applies to all of us. But here I could see it, mamish, openly. Baruch Hashem, in the end, I convinced her, and she didn't marry the guy, she married somebody else. This guy went on to have a very, very tragic life. Very tragic life. So, Baruch Hashem, I saved this girl. But in any case, that's the power of people. We're all like that. It's easy to see it in this girl, but it's harder to see it in ourselves. But that's what the Masilas Yesharim is saying. You can blind your eyes from seeing the truth. You can distort the truth. And that's how the Yetzer Hara fools a person who hasn't yet learned how to control his Yetzer Hara, which is, again, all of us are pretty much in that boat, because you're walking in the darkness. And in the darkness, you avoid seeing negative, and you see negative as positive, and positive as negative. Next week we'll see, so what's the Yetzer? So how do you get out of that and get through the field, right, without falling into the holes and without bumping into poles and thinking they're people? That's what he's going to discuss next.